Now started. If you're not talking, please press star six to mute your line. Thank you.
Liz, do people not already think that?
But you're such
what a way to
you're
start
such a,
the recording, huh?
You're such a you're such a nice dork, though.
Thanks, guys. I'm glad this is retained for posterity. Wow.
Well, we waited for it to start.
Okay, now that we have the all that recorded, or at least part of it, let's get started. Thanks, everybody, for joining and for the ongoing work on this. Glenn, you do such a nice job with the roll call. I'll let you do that since you're on the call after the other meeting.
Nicole Chuck-Gomes, Alan Greenberg from ALAC, David Maher, the Registry Constituency, Tim Ruiz, Registrar Constituency, James Bladell, Registrar Constituency, Steve Metellitz, IPC, Steve Del Bianco, BC, Business Constituency, and for staff we have Patrick Jones, Liz Gaster, and myself. Have I left off anybody?
Okay, thanks.
Fine.
Thanks, everyone. Any comments on the agenda before we start going through it? All right. Follow-up discussion then on what we did, the work we did last week, and let's start with the note number two at the for the table that Steve Del Bianco just added. Steve, why don't you walk us through that? Maybe even read it.
Excuse me, Mr. Yeltsin joined.
I said that note number two says that the hypothesis table below is intended to categorize, consolidate, and add relevant detail to the hypotheses originally submitted. As council considers which of these studies should be pursued, it will be up to the original study submissions, and I indicate the link. These original submissions include statements of how study results could lead to an improvement in WHOIS policy. Many submitters also describe the type of the survey or study needed, including data elements, data sources, population to be surveyed, and sample size. These original submissions should be used by council and its consultants in designing further studies and deciding which are worthwhile to pursue. That's what I've entered on the wiki, and it's a theme that I've mentioned on multiple previous calls when I try to return to the original submissions to show that the submitter, in some cases it was me, it was many of us, where I showed that the submitter anticipated the kind of data elements that we needed, the kind of a survey or study or test that would be required. And I know that those original submissions are difficult to find, that it's difficult to wade your way through them. I think it would be a complete waste to throw away the thought that went into them when council decides what next steps to take.
And we agreed last week to add a statement like this, and I think it makes perfect sense. Any discussion on what
Steve's note?
Yeah, this is Steve Metellitz.
Go ahead, Steve.
I think the note is fine, but I wonder if we should also say that in some cases we had to provide a hypothesis or put... draw a hypothesis out of the suggestion because it wasn't clearly stated in the suggestion. That's certainly true.
Anybody opposed to that? It sounds like a good idea to me.
I will add that to the first sentence, and I'll say that in some cases the hypothesis had to be inferred from the original submission.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's good.
Yeah, this is Lee Elgin. I just wanted to say I just joined, and obviously I agree with that too.
Thanks, Lee, and welcome. We did hear, see that you had joined, but since Steve Del Bianco started, I didn't want to interrupt him there. So.
No, me neither.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'll go ahead and put that sentence as you move on.
Okay, very good.
Chuck?
Yeah.
It's Alan. Steve said mentioned that the original documents are hard to find and hard to work through. We can't fix the latter, but we can fix the former. And make sure that we, in our final report, that we include either in some easy way find or in a table, you know, as a third column, what the original text was.
Well,
or a companion document or something.
Let me ask Liz if that's possible, Alan, in all cases, because in some cases the text gets pretty lengthy.
Well, then let's have a companion document, you know, one by one, so you can refer to them easily.
I can pull them all into one giant Word document. It's just going to be really big.
Well, but if we're recommending that someone look at them before making a decision, then I don't think we really have much option.
Well, that's going to be especially true. Well, I guess the council may need to do that some, but it's going to be especially true of any consultants that may be enlisted to look at how the studies might be designed. They're the ones we really want to look in detail, and it may be different consultants for different studies, so I'm not sure that it's all that useful to have everything all in one huge document as long as there are clear links to the studies.
Chuck, this is Steve. Can I speak to that?
Sure.
The risk of just simply pasting them all in is that we won't have added judgment about which parts of the original submissions actually are relevant. And that's something we have gone through with a number of these submissions so far. So I do believe we should have a hyperlink to the original page. And I provided that at the top of the wiki today. There's a link up there now to Who Is Study Suggestion.
Okay.
It includes the page where they're listed, and it includes the form that we were asked to submit them in. That's important. But I believe that as we prepare our final report, it won't be that difficult to jump back over then to the original submission, scan it quickly to see where it was clear that the submitter put time and thought into the implications on policy, where the submitter said, this has to be a test and not a survey, or where the submitter actually indicated data elements. It won't be but a few extra hours probably Liz's time, to pull that stuff into our final submission, our final report, because it's too much to expect people to constantly link back to the originals and figure out what's important and what's not.
Steve, it's no problem for me. Whatever the group thinks makes sense, I'm happy to
do. Well, in our final report, let me ask this question of Liz. Is it easy to separately link each study suggestion? And the reason I'm asking that is I wonder if in our final report, within each study area, we should provide the link to that specific suggestion.
I can do that too.
I mean, is that would make it really clear as we go through, if they do have separate links, that might be make it very clear with a direct reference in the table to each study. What thoughts on that?
This is Steve. I think that's necessary but not sufficient, because it doesn't add the other element, which is some judgment about which part of those submissions should be looked at. You can't rely on the reader to always click the link, but in fact, if we highlight and pull up their parts of it that clearly demonstrated that some thought went into it and that we think is relevant to council's consideration, it should be repeated in our final document, not just linked.
That's not part of our mandate, Steve. I mean, we're supposed to be coming up with hypotheses. We'll get a little bit away from that as it is. But, you know, to start saying, well, here's other relevant portions of these proposals that you should take into account, I mean, that's not what we were asked to do.
Is that Tim?
That's Tim.
That's an excellent point. I want to try to refresh my memory about our charter. Were we restricted to only actually summarize and categorize hypotheses, or were we asked to provide council with information to consider for whether to pursue any further studies?
It's pretty narrow. It's to make sure there's a clearly stated brief hypothesis or hypotheses for each study.
It did allow for including, you know, information as to why we ended up with that hypothesis, which we're doing somewhat in different ones. But I think, you know, pointing out other relevant portions of the proposals, you know, as being like you're suggesting, is getting kind of beyond what we
now. it's been my opinion all along that anything we can do without getting too far off of mission to facilitate the council making some decisions will be helpful and appreciated. I guess my question...
And I think the note number two there on the wiki is getting there, right? I mean, that's a general note I think we're all in agreement to include that, you know, makes it clear that, you know, there's more to consider here than just these hypotheses, which I'm sure the counselors understand anyway, but so we already have that note included.
Yeah, now, Steve Del Bianco, it's not clear how we would accomplish what you're doing without adding quite a significant amount of information to the report. What are you exactly thinking? How would you fit it into a report to accomplish what you're doing?
It's a fair question, so I'll just use an example. Area 6 was the one I worked on last week. And under Area 6, once we consolidate, one of the core hypotheses would be that some registrars are not revealing the registered data as required under the RAA. You all remember that discussion. In the submission for that study, study number 3, we indicated in the submission that this wouldn't actually be a survey, but it would have to be a test where we would actually provide evidence of actionable harm to a certain number of proxy servers and determine the amount of time and accuracy with which a reply came back. And I could be wrong here, but I have felt that that suggestion will help to inform counsel about whether to proceed or not, since it defines the scope and difficulty and to some extent informs the cost of doing a study, a test in this case, that would figure that out. And it also demonstrates to counsel that this isn't something that would be picked up in the routine audit that Doug Brent is doing on registrar compliance today, since nothing I've seen indicates that those audits include tests of the reveal obligation. So I'm in a dilemma, folks. I think Tim's right about scope, and I hate scope creep. I really do. But we have put a lot of work into this, so when it gets to counsel, let's design the most expeditious way that the readers of the report will know that there's more than just the summary, that will be easy for them to click over and find it. And I guess that was Chuck's point about putting a hyperlink. Every place where we indicate a study submission, that ought to be a hyperlink to the original. And that gets halfway there. And if this group feels that it goes too far, if we start pasting in what we think is relevant, then I'll go along with the group.
Let me make a suggestion in a way to handle this, because what I'd really like, I really want as soon as possible to get to the point where we can send back the hypotheses we've drafted to the submitters who are not involved in this group, so that we can, you know, get any comments they have in a short time period. So what I'd like to suggest, if there's no opposition, is that we defer this particular issue and how we handle it until we get the hypotheses done, which will probably mean the next meeting, and maybe we'll even finish them this meeting, so that we can get that time clock started and getting some responses back if there are any. Is that anybody opposed to that approach?
Chuck, I like the approach it's list, but I have an additional suggestion, too. I need to go back and look at the first document that we compiled that actually had more of a description of what the study was and the methodology, too, because I still think they were abbreviated descriptions, but they were more robust in the way that I think Steve is trying to get at. And I could take another look at that and maybe add the links to that and see if we could use that as a appendix or attachment that would at least have more color to the detail associated with each one. And I'd be happy to work with Steve, if he's willing, to gussy that up, you know, check it and make sure, you know, it's good reflection, but it might be a starting point that's already been done that we could work from.
Steve, are you willing to do that with Liz?
Of course. It's like putting a couple of dorks together. We'll be fine.
Nice dorks. Nice dorks.
We have two dorks on this group. Aha.
But Alan said we were nice, so I want to hold that.
Chuck, this is Tim. I just have one other. If we're good to go on that for now, I have one other request as far as
a minor change
goes. Anybody else have a comment on
that? Yeah, I have a quick comment, Alan. I may not be on the next meeting, so I'll say it now, so maybe someone will remember. I think the real issue that I started off this discussion with is to make sure that whoever comes next in this process has access, reasonably ready access. And I would hate that all the work we did in preparing the hypothesis is lost. And somehow, you know, if we can do something easy, you know, whether it's simply taking the original text and highlighting what the person who wrote the hypothesis thinks are the pertinent parts, just to make sure that the next group doesn't have to redo all the work we did all over again, or worse, miss something important that we got.
Right. Anyone else before Tim has the floor again? Okay, Tim.
Just in the first note on the wiki, the first sentence there talks about throughout this document the term registrant or registrant data refers to what is sometimes called the actual registrant or customer of the proxy privacy service. I think that is would be more accurate by saying it's sometimes called the beneficial user or customer of the proxy privacy service. Because not in all cases, in some cases, the actual registrant, just as the 3.7.7.3 there states, is the proxy or privacy service. They are the registered name holders. So it seems a little contradictory there, and it's probably more accurate to say that they're sometimes called the beneficial user or customer of the proxy privacy
service. Tim, so you're changing the first part of the note, is that right? Why don't you repeat that for Liz's benefit?
I'm changing two words. So the first sentence would read, throughout this document, the term registrant or registrant data refers to what is sometimes called the beneficial user or customer of the proxy privacy service.
Any objections to that?
Tim, do you think that should still be in quotes, beneficial user?
Yes.
Okay, I think so too. I wanted to check with you.
Yes.
Okay. Any opposition to that?
No.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. If there's nothing else on that for now, and thanks, Steve and Liz, for volunteering to work on that other issue.
And Steve, I'll get in touch with you offline on that.
So,
this is James.
Yes, James.
Just real quickly, do we want to mention in note 2 any of our work relative to consulting the GAC questions?
In particular, what are you suggesting?
Well, note 2 refers the council back to the original list of submissions, and I wonder if there is a need for a separate note 3 referring to the list of GAC questions, or if that can be somehow shoehorned into that paragraph, that those were also considered and factored and associated with the most parallel hypothesis wherever appropriate.
Now, I was assuming that the GAC submissions were inclusive there, but...
let's make a separate note.
I have a suggestion. It's Liz. Steve, you may not want to incorporate this with the note you suggested, but what we could do, we added that sentence anyway, so it could read, the hypotheses table below is intended to categorize, consolidate, and add relevant detail to the hypotheses originally submitted. In some cases, as with the GAC recommendations, the hypotheses needed to be inferred from the information submitted.
All right, I'll make that change right now.
Does that work for you?
James, is that good?
Yeah, that's perfect.
I think that's a good suggestion.
Okay, thanks.
Do we also want to put in a link to the GAC?
Suggestions. This is Steve Metallic. So we also want to put in a link to the GAC suggestions along with our link to the original study submissions.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
And so they're not at that link that Steve provided. Okay, thanks.
Right.
Good catch. Good catch.
I'll add that, too.
All right. Good. Anything else on the notes?
So, Liz, you go ahead and make that change. But
yes,
make
I
sure
will.
You refresh first, please, because I had already put in the earlier suggestion.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So now we're to last week. We developed hypotheses for areas 5 and 6. I didn't see any discussion on the list on those. Does anybody have any points they want to bring up on those before we move on to Area 7?
Yeah, this is Steve Metallitz. I just had one question. On Recommendation 12, at least as it was summarized in our earlier documents, didn't actually say anything about who is accuracy. I assume as registrations would become more accurate, I assume that refers to the accuracy of the WHOIS data. And I'm sorry I missed this part of the discussion last week, but was that part of what was proposed there?
Let's take a look at
it just says inventory privacy and law enforcement requirements for WHOIS. That's just the summary.
So 12. Let's see, I've got that. Where's my... Oh, here we go. I was trying to find the... there it is. Okay, study 12 under area 6. Let's see, that was submitted by Wout Denatjes of the Netherlands, and it was inventory privacy and law enforcement requirements for WHOIS. That's where... Liz, there was a staff note. No hypothesis was provided. The following was provided as utility for such a study, and that was the better the data in WHOIS is and a proportional access is assured, the less the need for strict rules for access will be. Now, Steve Metallitz, when they're talking about the better the data is, do you not think that that's referring to accuracy?
I guess it could be.
I don't know. I'm just raising the question.
Accuracy and completeness.
Yeah.
Is this on the wiki somewhere? I'm not seeing any of that terminology.
No, I had a word table that Liz had prepared with the brief summaries, and I was just reading from that.
Got it.
This was not the most articulate submission. Yeah. I think there was probably a language issue.
It's a language issue. But,
yeah.
But I guess just when I saw this in the, this hypothesis, was there any discussion last week about how you would test this hypothesis? Registrations would become more accurate if the sensitive information of private persons can be secured while giving law enforcement access. I mean, maybe that's not our job, but it doesn't.
I don't remember.
Sure,
we did do that in some cases. I don't remember if we did on this one. But let's just look at this. Is there maybe an easy way to fix the hypothesis to deal with your concern? I don't know that anybody was locked into the word accurate. Is there a suggestion as how we might reword this to better express it?
This is Steve Del Bianco. I had tried to infer this from study submission number 12. And what he really talked about, he had a multi-part topic. He kept talking about accuracy of data, implying that the submitters will lie about who they really are if they're afraid data will be misused. So to the extent that they're assured that it's not misused, they would be more willing to put in accurate information.
Okay. So did he use the word accurate? Or is that your own?
His utility was, quote, the better the data is in WHOIS. He talked about the better data. He talked about how can registrations become more false proof. So the word false proof. This is a tough one. If you look at the suggestion, it's not as, it doesn't really adhere to the kind of rigor of vocabulary we've been trying to use.
Yeah.
And is he really talking about registrations would become more accurate, or registration information?
Or WHOIS data, maybe.
Yeah, WHOIS data is probably even better. Yeah.
I think he's talking about WHOIS data.
Yeah.
I believe it's WHOIS data.
Okay, I'll make that change.
Now, what about the word accurate, though, that Steve raised, Steve Metallitz?
Less subject to intentional falsification.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Again, I'm not quite sure how you're going to test this hypothesis.
Let's just spend a little bit of time thinking about that. So we're talking about who is data would be right now. If we just reword it, who is data would become more accurate if the sensitive information of private persons can be secured while giving law enforcement access.
The only way to test that is to survey people that say that they gave false information in WHOIS and say to them, if you were assured that the data were secured and only law enforcement had access, would you be inclined to put accurate information in?
Yeah, this is the kind of thing I think that could be tested in a longitudinal study where the you get a good sampling before anything is done to protect privacy and giving law enforcement access, and then doing it again over a few years afterwards might be tested that way. I'm not sure it's the kind of study that would be practical for us to do, but I suppose it could be if you did a long-term study like that.
You know, the other thing is that the plan, I guess, is for the council would select some studies to be scoped further, and that would be part of the scoping, how realistic it would be to actually...
No, I understand that.
Yeah, because I think that's really tough.
Yeah, I would think that what Steve Del Bianco just said might be helpful. Instead of saying would become more accurate, say would become less subject to intentional falsification.
And to Steve, to put that a little further, we could say that registrants would be less likely to falsify their WHOIS data.
Yes.
Anybody have a problem with that? That sounds pretty good to me.
No, that sounds good.
Got it.
Okay, you got it?
Yep.
Anything else on areas 5 or 6? Thanks, Steve and Talis, for that. Bringing that one up. I think that is much better. Okay, let's go to Area 7. And James submitted some starting points for us on Study 8, first of all. And note in his that he has a couple parenthetical inserts in the first one there. His suggestion was some registrars knowingly tolerate inaccurate or falsified WHOIS data to financially gain from spammers and other bad actors, and because there are no consequences for doing so. And then the provided hypothesis or hypotheses were provided there as well. Discussion on that.
Hi, Chuck. This is James.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that there were 4 elements I thought within this study that I wanted to get captured in a hypothesis, whether we want a long drawn out sentence like that one or whether we wanted to break them up into separate ABCs. I would leave that to the group. But the 4 elements were: there was an awareness element, that registrars were aware that there was inaccurate data in their WHOIS. That there's a correlation or link between the submission of false data and spammers, and I added other bad actors. There was a implication of a financial benefit to registrars for tolerating this, and then the final element from the study was that there's absolutely no enforcement or negative consequences for doing this. And I tried to kind of glom those all into a single sentence there. So if it's a little tortured, we can work on that.
Thanks, James. Thoughts on that?
Well, the one thing I would mention here is that the this is Steve Metallitz. I'm sorry. The original proposal said this would be based on non-response to WHOIS data problem reports. First, that doesn't, I mean, that's how registrars would know about this. So I think James has captured it by saying registrars knowingly tolerate. But I just would point out that, again, this kind of overlaps pretty significantly with something that contract compliance unit is already doing. Again, maybe this is not our role to point that out, but I suggested we want to mention that.
Now, when we combine four elements like is done here, does it make it a little more complicated in terms of a testable hypothesis? And I guess what the question I'm asking is it better to separate it into multiple hypotheses instead of one all-encompassing one? Thoughts on that? I don't have strong feelings one way or another. I just want to throw that out as a question for discussion. Are people, anybody not comfortable with what James has proposed here? Or any suggested changes? So, in other words, we could remove the parentheses, and the hypothesis for Study 8 would be some registrars knowingly tolerate inaccurate or falsified WHOIS data to financially gain from spammers and other bad actors. And because there are no consequences for doing so.
This is Steve Delpion. I have a question.
Go ahead.
James, two questions, really. The first is, do we imply something like financial gain? Are we implying a financial interest, or is it just inferring that they simply keep the fees from people who shouldn't otherwise be allowed to register the domain? Does
the
financial gain apply just keeping fees?
I think that I think the implication is that fees, because it says that the actual text from the original study is these registrars benefit financially by harboring spammers. So I don't believe there's any skin in the game beyond the fees.
So I agree with that interpretation, having read the original, and I don't want to seem overly accusatory here, as if they're getting a cut or a take from the money that's made by spammers or fraudsters. All we're really implying by this hypothesis is that they earn and retain fees for registration. And is there a way to change the way the language reads to remove the implication that they're participating financially in the spam?
And is it correct, James, that the study proposed that there was no indication that they meant some sort of collaborative effort with regard to financially gaining from spam or something like that?
Well, you could say to retain fees from spammers instead of financially gain.
Or from registrations by...
Yep.
Right. To retain fees from registrations by spammers.
Yes, I think that would be helpful. James, does that make sense?
That's excellent.
And the second question is this. When counsel receives this, immediately somebody at staff is going to say, wait a minute, we're already doing audits of data accuracy. We already have a program underway for that. And so it only helps counsel if we describe ways in which this is or is not covered by WHOIS data accuracy that's going on today in an existing program.
Well, this Steve Mattel, this is really my point, which was not so much from WHOIS data accuracy, but there's a whole separate audit on WHOIS data problem response. If our registrar is responding to data problem reports that they receive. I'm just saying we might want to flag this, that whoever takes this the next step on this, if they do, probably ought to talk to the contract compliance to try to minimize overlap.
Yeah, and I think that's going to have to be done in several of these proposed studies, and that the council's going to need to take that into consideration here. And I think that will pretty naturally be a focus by the council when it makes decisions on which of these to take to the next step. Now, the question, I guess, is do we need to comment on that here? And I'll defer to the group on that in terms of what you want to do.
Could we get there by just modifying the hypotheses slightly, by saying that after that, after the comma there, because the consequences for doing so do not serve as a sufficient deterrent.
Reactions to that?
Well, I think, this is Steve, I think we've got two separate questions here. One is, maybe we should think about putting a separate note, since we've already got two notes, maybe we could have a third note, that says, in evaluating these, the council may want to consult with the contract compliance staff to minimize overlap or something like that. I mean, that applies to several of these. It's not
yeah, it does. It really does.
So maybe we just have a general statement like that.
Tim, I think that's not a bad idea. That's a good idea, I think.
The second point is that you know, looking at this, we've been trying to minimize statements of causation here since we're trying to do factual studies. And maybe we should just say, I like the idea that of the sanctions are not sufficient to deter them. Maybe we need to change this into registrars that knowingly tolerate inaccurate or falsified WHOIS data, one, financially gain from the registration fees of spenders and other bad actors, and two, are not deterred by any enforcement consequences or something like that.
Now, one concern I have with that, Steve, is that it is the very first part. I think one part of the hypothesis is that there are some registrars who knowingly tolerate, and the way you worded it, that wasn't so much something to be tested as it was an assumption, I think.
Yeah, maybe we would say any registrars who knowingly tolerate, but you're right. Maybe that is part of the hypothesis, too.
Is that right, James? Part of the hypothesis is that there are some who knowingly tolerate inaccurate.
I agree, Chuck, that there are four questions here and that we can combine them in a tortured sentence, or we can break them up, but if we start to put them into a hierarchy of sorts, I think that's kind of the interpretation that someone would take away.
So I'm back to the question I asked before. Does it make sense to break these up into several different hypotheses rather than one big one?
This is Steve. I kind of like James's tortured sentence here, actually, because I think it really does kind of cover everything. And maybe we should just say, I mean, leaving the first part of the sentence as it is, and then with that change about financial gain, I just want to take the word because out of there.
Yeah,
because
okay.
That just implies or actually states causation. Maybe we just say, and do not face or and suffer no deterrent consequences for doing so.
Or do not face sufficient consequences.
Well, deterrent, I think, was a good...
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. So what do we have?
Do not face deterrent consequences for doing so. Instead of and because there are.
Yeah. Any problems with that? So what do you have, Liz?
hang on. Some registrars knowingly tolerate inaccurate or falsified WHOIS data to retain fees from registrations by spammers and do not face consequences for doing so.
And other bad actors. Did you have other bad actors?
Oh, and other bad actors, right. And do not face sufficient consequences for doing so?
Deterrent consequences.
Deterrent. Okay.
Got all that?
Yep.
Any further discussion on that? Okay. All right. Then let's go to Hypothesis 11. And, James, I'll let you talk about this one.
Okay, thanks. For Hypothesis 11, the I would like to really throw this out to the group and see if there's any consensus for determining whether this is within scope of our task or whether we should really mark it as out of bounds. But the way I restated the hypothesis was the inclusion of non-ASCII character sets in, there's a parenthetical there, certain fields of either web-based or port 43 WHOIS records will detract from data accuracy and readability. And my note there was that this study appears to touch on the technical challenges of implementing non-ASCII character sets in WHOIS and some of the confusion that can arise, and also the potential for homographic attacks.
This is Steve Del Bianco. I was the submitter for number 11.
Oh, okay.
And let me try to clarify a little bit. I think you've captured it as well, and it may be out of scope, but I'll make the best clarification I can, and then we can all decide. What I wrote in the original hypothesis was the use of IDN characters. I didn't write non-ASCII, I said IDN, because I think we all know what that means now. The use of IDN characters in TLD, specifically, will impair the accuracy and readability of WHOIS records displaying the domain name, email addresses, and name server addresses. So what I was getting at there is that the WHOIS data, to the extent it includes domains, will include TLDs, and to the extent IDNs are introduced in the TLD space, there will be IDN characters showing up in a WHOIS record being read by law enforcement to the extent that the public reads it, and also consumer protection bureaus. And what I'm concerned about is that certain, in some cases, homographic, what do we hear? That the Cyrillic PayPal.com looks just like the ASCII, but they're not the same. That there probably are opportunities for inaccuracies. It'll be introduced by allowing TLDs to be displayed in WHOIS. I'm not suggesting in any way that would lead to disallowing it, but it might change the way the WHOIS is displayed and change the standards of display to ensure that they're continue to be read accurately by those who do have legitimate reasons to read it.
Now, this particular issue is one that raises all kinds of questions in my mind. First of all, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that we really don't have an adequate WHOIS protocol to deal with IDN, whether it's the second level or top level or anywhere. Am I correct on that?
Chuck, I think that's correct, although we have a varying degree of support for IDNs through the web-based WHOIS that are offered by registries and registrars. But the underlying protocol, you're correct, is that there is not currently IDN support, or it's not defined outside of the ASCII space.
Thanks. And in the case of web-based WHOIS, port 80, there's no standard, right? Registrars do their own thing in that regard. Am I correct on that? And as far as displaying IDN characters?
I think that there are browser dependencies and there are data storage dependencies on whether the registrar is storing only the localized IDN contact information or whether they are storing that plus some sort of encoding, like similar to PUNY code. But you're correct in that there's a variety of different ways that can be implemented.
Yeah.
Even in, this is Tim, so even in port 43, I mean, there seems to be some, not necessarily an adherence to the strict standard of ASCII only in port 43, so we've seen that too. And then I'd just like to comment on the scope issue.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I just wonder if that's really a question we need to answer, you know, that whether the proposed study is or isn't within scope of what. I mean, our scope is to try to define a testable hypothesis as close as we can get for the proposed study. And I think James made a fairly good stab at that. And then the discussion about scope would be reserved more for the council deliberation, and not necessarily something we have to try to figure out.
This is Steve Del Bianco. Tim's right. And when council tries to figure out about scope, that's one of these great examples where I would refer council straight back to the original submission. Because in the original submission, I said there wasn't a study needed. Instead, this requires a technical analysis, because remember the WHOIS submissions, there were two things you could submit, a study / survey or a technical analysis. And I said that this requires a technical analysis of how the entry of IDN TLDs and WHOIS information could increase risks of inaccurate data, particularly through use of client-side software that fails to properly check the syntax of a field that might contain both IDN and ASCII strings. And that'll often be the case with email addresses and name server records. I said that this analysis should examine and recommend methods to display IDN-based WHOIS information such that those who access WHOIS can effectively read, recognize, and reliably use the information to reach the registrant contact and name server resources. I said there was no data needed since it's just a technical analysis. It's the kind of analysis that staff might do or consultants might do, but it would certainly lead to useful policy changes, like a standardization on how registrants enter information with syntax checking, and standards on how it's displayed, and standards on how it's read through port 43.
So, Steve, this is an excellent example of the point you were making earlier in terms of going back to the original study. And based on what you just said, and this is one of the reasons why I was struggling with this one, is that it's really not so a study, it's a technical analysis, and so maybe a hypothesis isn't even appropriate here.
I think the hypothesis could still be there, because frankly, if accuracy is not a problem because of IDN, if IDN doesn't increase the accuracy problems, then you probably don't need to do the technical analysis. But actually, I think the hypothesis probably still works.
Now, maybe this is a case where, you know, we would add some, you know, we would add a note to the specific hypothesis to explain, make it clear that the hypothesis should be looked at in light of the fact that this is a suggested technical analysis and not a proposed study.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
generally,
I think,
make some kind of prejudgment that this is out of scope or whatever based on the hypothesis.
Right. The last thing I want to suggest is to go out and survey the records that are being used today with IDNs in them.
It's not at all
what we're talking about.
Yeah, this is a case, I think, where that note is really needed. Anybody disagree with that?
If all we do is provoke ICANN to study it and come up with a policy on how the data is gathered and displayed, we'll have done a service to the community. So we don't want to miss that chance.
Yeah, and this is a real live issue. I mean, regardless of what we say on this one, this is the whole WHOIS issue with regard to IDNs has lots of potential issues that need to be resolved and haven't been. So totally aside from all the other issues with WHOIS, putting those in the background, there are some real issues here. So what do we have in terms of the suggested note with this hypothesis is what again?
Chuck, this is James.
Mm-hmm.
Just a further question, and maybe it's just something I'm not getting clear on, but we're using words like IDN and non-ASCII character sets somewhat interchangeably, and Steve, you know, help me with your submission. You were specifically addressing contact information fields, correct?
I said three things: the contact information field, the domain name, and the name server addresses. Those are all elements of whois.
Okay. So
they all contain TLDs.
Okay. So the domain name and the name server would have an encoding standard, but the contact information would not, and it would have to be stored either in a localized character set, a non-ASCII character set, or there would have to be some to-be-determined encoding standard for that.
I would say this, how it is stored, I would say is completely up to the registrar. I was getting at how it is entered by the user, and it has to be syntax checking, and number two, how it is displayed to those who are allowed to have access. So how it's stored is up to folks like Tim, right? But I would say that how it's entered and how it's displayed is what matters to the community.
Yeah, I mean, it, even if the technical analysis doesn't touch on it, I mean, I think it even extends into things like the name fields, the address fields. I think could all potentially be affected. If somebody's registering an IDN, there's a high likelihood that, you know, they're going to be entering the other contact fields in another language as well, potentially.
You know, that's something I'm afraid I had missed, and that's a very wise statement. I was focusing on IDNs and the TLD portions of the information. What you're bringing up is the person's street address and phone number, which contain no TLDs at all, might also contain non-ASCII characters. Is that your point?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, and those are issues we've struggled with as we've looked at IDM implementation and what really makes sense for, you know, the registrants are going to be highly interested in that as things move forward. But, you know, I don't mean to just get ourselves off track here, but I just think it's a big enough issue that it's worth considering, and I wouldn't want to call this out of scope. It still affects whois policy, and I think it's, you know, something that should be seriously considered. So whatever we have to do to add a note here to make sure that that's clear, I think we should do it.
So, what again is the note that we're adding?
Well, I was suggesting, this is Tim again, I was suggesting that it be something like that the hypothesis should be considered in light of the fact that this is a proposed technical analysis and not a proposed study.
Get that, Liz?
I'm typing. Almost.
Tim, the two sentences that I included in the submission, which expanded that, I would have proposed that those sentences also make their way into our report, and some folks feel that might be going too far. The two sentences were that this requires a technical analysis of how the entry of IDN, TLDs, and whois information could increase the risks of inaccurate data, particularly through client-side software that fails to check the syntax of fields. And second sentence was that this analysis should examine and recommend methods to display IDN-based whois information such that those accessing whois can effectively read, recognize, and reliably use the information to reach the registrant contact and name server resources. Tim, do you feel like that's relevant enough to pull it up into our table, into our report, or whether our readers have to go find that in the underlying submission?
Well, I'm not sure how others would feel about it, but I guess I would be okay with that in there as, as a quote from the report. So, you know, we could include the note, and then for example, you know, the technical analysis requests, and then quote or something to that effect.
I'd be very happy with that.
I really do see this one as a special case, where I think that's justifiable, in contrast to the way we've handled all the others. Anybody disagree with that?
So it's Liz. We would have a precatory sentence that says, note, the hypothesis should be considered in light of the fact that this is a proposed technical analysis and not a study. And then we would insert Steve's language.
I think that's correct. Is that
okay?
Correct?
And I would go further that Tim and James have gone one better than me, because here I was only focusing on the IDNs and the TLDs, but more broadly, it's non-ASCII characters in any of the whois information.
Yeah.
Like the address, phone number, and name.
So how would that change from the hypothesis that's there that James wrote?
James is probably better than what I had.
So I can delete the brackets.
We could, Liz, this is James. We could, for example, say something to the effect of the inclusion of IDNs in, and I'm
in TLD.
Using the term fully qualified domain names, and non-ASCII characters in contact information. It becomes a little bit of a complicated sentence, but if we associate IDNs with the TLDs and the domain names and then non-ASCII characters with the contact information, name, address, phone number, then maybe that those two would go together more clearly.
I'd agree with that, James. That's a good point.
So we would have the inclusion of IDNs and TLDs and non-ASCII character sets in the contact information of... Do you want to use web-based or port 43?
This is Steve DelBianco. I would recommend not putting web-based in port 43 because
just say who is
they are just access methods to the underlying data, and we want to look at all access methods, whether it's web-based or port 43, to be sure that they're providing a consistent and readable and usable information to the reader.
Well, I agree with you, Steve. It doesn't belong there anymore, and we should just go right to who is records will detract from data accuracy and readability. I would point out that you're right. They are methods of retrieval, but they will handle it very differently, and I think that treating them as equals would probably hamstring the technical analysis.
We need to identify those two different methods in the technical analysis sentences that we're going to throw in the bottom.
Okay, that's a good place for it.
Steve, you want to shoot me over that couple of sentences once you've got it?
Yeah, I'll just cut and paste it from the original submission and add the 43.
Okay. And did you want to add the broader definition in terms of contact information, Steve?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Good point.
Okay. So, without having Steve's exact language again there, what do we have now, Liz?
We have the inclusion of IDNs and TLDs and non-ASCII character sets in the contact information of who is records will detract from data accuracy and readability. Note, the hypothesis should be considered in light of the fact that this is a proposed technical analysis and not a study. And then we would insert Steve's text.
Now, one thing I don't understand is why do we have in TLDs in there? Because does it really matter whether it's at the top level or at the second level?
Well,
the problem's the same, is it not?
We can say TLDs or domain names, but I think the email address, the domain name and the email address, and the domain name and the name servers may be foreign to that particular TLD.
Here's how it might read. This requires a technical analysis of how use of IDNs in domain names and use of non-ASCII characters in who is contact information. But is IDN redundant with non-ASCII characters?
Not necessarily. I wouldn't think so, but I'll throw that out to the smarter folks on the team.
It seems redundant to me, but what are you thinking there, James?
When I think about IDN, I think of there is a encoding or a mapping between IDN to represent it in ASCII. That's not true of non-ASCII character sets.
But non-ASCII character sets
are non-standard.
More precise, is it not?
I'm sorry?
Isn't non-ASCII character sets more precise than saying IDN characters? Because you're right, the whole IDN protocol and so forth involves an elaborate mapping scheme and lots of other things, too. But basically what we're talking about is non-ASCII character sets, are we not?
For the contact fields, that is correct. That is precise.
And probably also for the name server names and the email addresses of the contact fields, too.
But those could also be IDN.
Does the use of the phrase non-ASCII characters include IDN?
Yeah, I think non-ASCII character is better because then there's no confusion over when someone sees IDN, if they're thinking, when I see IDN, I'm thinking the non-ASCII character. Someone else might see IDN and they might be thinking of the puny code ASCII mapping of those characters. So, and I think that's the point is it's the non-ASCII character set that we're concerned about, not the mapped to ASCII puny code, which is not a problem. Although that in itself can also affect readability in that, XN dash gobbledygook.
Right, right.
Does it mean a whole hell of a lot to a lot of people?
Well, in fact, James, are you thinking of both?
Name.
Both the puny code representation and the localized character set?
I'm sorry, well, I didn't hear the first part of your
question. What I'm asking, James, is are you concerned about both the puny code representation, the XN dash dash and a bunch of ASCII characters, being a problem, as well as the localized representation in non-ASCII characters?
This is Tim. I can give you my opinion, and it may not be the overriding one, but that the XN dash dash whatever is the issue, because that's not what consumers want to see in their records. It's not what they're going to really connect with or understand. What they're going to connect with and understand is the representation of that in their local language. And so ultimately that's where we feel, we need to get to, is how can we give a fair representation of that in their local language, which is what they expect to see, and then have that work and comply and meet all the needs that everyone sees or has in regards to the WHOIS contact information. So there's a lot of issues there. They're not, it's not cut and dry. There's no simple way to describe it. There's a lot of different issues associated with that. But that's ultimately the issue. You've got the consumer who wants to see things in the local language that they entered them in, and then you've got users of that data who want to be able to see it and understand it, and they may be getting it in XN dash dash or in the local language, either one of which could potentially cause problems given the current WHOIS standards.
So in the
if that helps or not, I don't know. But
so in the case of domain name and anything else in the WHOIS record that uses a domain name, whatever level of that, it's both the localized display in the localized script and the puny code representation of the name that are issues in this case. In the case of contact information, it's really the localized script that we're concerned with.
This is Steve. This will be a surprising statement for me, but that is almost what I would say is beyond the scope of an analysis suggestion by taking them just a little too far. It might be safer to say that the technical analysis of how the use of non-ASCII characters in WHOIS data elements might increase risks of inaccuracy, particularly through use of client-side software, etc. So the use of non-ASCII characters in WHOIS data elements becomes a catchphrase that I think covers entry and retrieval and storage of non-ASCII characters that are used as part of domain names or street addresses.
So, Steve, then translate that into what you think the hypothesis should say now.
The use of non-ASCII characters in WHOIS data elements will detract from data accuracy and readability.
Comments on that? Any, anybody opposed, have any changes to that or any opposition to that? Okay, and then we're going to add on that the general note and then the text, the modified text from Steve's actual submission. Is that right?
I slightly modified from the original submission to incorporate the comments
right.
that came up on this call. So.
Yeah, that's what I meant by the modified version of what you had in your submission. So, Liz, are you with us?
Yeah, I think so. the use of non-ASCII character sets in WHOIS records will detract from data accuracy and readability.
I think that Steve struck the word sets and just used non-ASCII characters.
Thanks.
Is that correct, Steve?
That's right. Use of non-ASCII characters in WHOIS and the word records, or I could say data elements, which is more descriptive.
Okay.
Is records okay?
It's okay with me. Anybody opposed to that? Now, do we want to include the parenthetical web-based or port 43, or is that unnecessary?
I think that were we including that in your language for the note, Steve?
Yes.
So it can probably be removed from there.
Okay.
Got it.
And we can remove the certain fields of as well, because that is captured in either records or data elements.
Right. Got it.
Okay. Anything else on study 11? What I'm going to say is definitely out of scope for this, okay? But this discussion convinces me more than ever that one of the things that GNSS really needs to work on is this whole issue of who is display involving IDN names. But that's a totally separate issue, not related to this.
Chuck,
okay.
I'd just like to thank Steve real quickly. One of the things I think I pinged you early on working on this was I would like to reach out to the original submitter, so it's great to have him on the call.
You bet.
Okay. Area 8, then, is other GAC recommendations. And what I did on this one is Eric Bruner-Williams, who has a conflict every time we have this call, had made some suggestions for the GAC studies that are listed here. 1, 5, 6, and 3. Now, didn't we deal with one or two of those previously? GAC 1, let's see, I thought I saw GAC 1. Maybe not. Oh, yeah, GAC 1 was in Area 5, right? So we want to go back to that. And GAC 2 was in Area 5. And we actually, oh, so that's not one of these. Okay, so it's, so 1's a duplicate. What about 5, 6, and 3? Did we do anything with those elsewhere? I'm just doing a quick scan here. I don't think so. If anybody finds any one of those other three, I don't think so. So I don't know. Let's look at 1, realizing that we have already done something with 1, so we may want to just revert back to what we've already done. But what we had done, if we go back up to Area 5 for GAC 1, was we said the legitimate use of GTLD WHOIS data is curtailed or prevented by the use of proxy and privacy registration services. And then what Eric did there, the amount and source of WHOIS requests is non-uniform, and that the non-uniformity is interpretable, and a likely interpretation is that data point clusters will correlate with intent in a reference data set, and then he has an alternative, or some subset of registrar raw data minimally containing just the data and source of WHOIS request data is disclosed to a third party for data analysis, and that use cases for WHOIS data may be discerned from clusters in a reference WHOIS access data set, and that the use cases and statistical correlates are disclosed to the GAC ROPO. And with all due respect to Eric, he certainly has a way of wording things in a complicated way.
Chuck,
Chuck, this is Steve Metallitz. This seems to describe a totally different study than
it
what
sure
you read from Group 5. And I wonder whether, I'm just looking at our original list of summary of public suggestions, you know, it says GAC bullet number 1. The other ones say GAC recommendation number 5, 6, or 3. This says GAC bullet number 1. Is that something different? I don't have the GAC.
Well, yeah, the GAC recommendations had like 2 study suggestions. Or I don't have it in front of me either, but they had 2 study suggestions in front of them, and they had a whole bunch of, you know, 15 or so different things that could be then learned or studied by virtue of that research. So there were these sort of precatory 2 research areas, and then the hypothesis, not the hypotheses, but the information you would then glean or study from those, like, 15 different options.
I can read you the first bullet if it would help.
Yeah, I think so.
So I have the GAC in front of me. Liz is accurately describing the GAC report had 2 bullets, and then they followed it up with a list of 15 different questions to ask about the data. The first bullet was, they want data on the amount and source of traffic, accessing who is servers, and the types and numbers of the different groups of users, and what all those users are using who is for.
So is it, did I capture, this is not GAC study 1, it's GAC bullet 1, is that different?
Yeah, I think that when the GAC laid it out, Liz described it accurately, the GAC believes that studies of whose data should be undertaken to create a factual record, and that the goal should be to initially compile data that provides documented evidence base regarding the 2 bullets. And I just read you the first bullet. The second bullet has to do with the types and extent of who is misuse, which I think we covered earlier. So there'd be 2 bullets, one about who's accessing who is servers, and what are they doing with it, and the second bullet was the type and extent of misuse. And then the GAC said that given that, once this basic data is collected, the GAC wants further analysis to be directed towards answering the following question. And then there are 15 questions that are asked. We'll call those analysis in this format. Analysis of the data that was gathered in the 2 bullets. And I tried. I called the U.S. government. I tried to get them to reformat it to fit the submission. But you talk about herding cats. There was no way the GAC would come to that.
So what's the thinking? I guess the first basic question I have is, do I have it captured incorrectly when I say GAC 1? Does it really duplicate with the GAC 1 we have up above in Area 5?
It conflicts with it because they're not the same thing.
Okay, so it should be labeled something different than GAC 1. Should it be labeled GAC Bullet 1, like was in Liz's thing?
GAC data set 1, and then GAC data set 2, as opposed to calling them bullets, because those are the data sets.
It strikes me that really those bullets are not something from which you could draw a hypothesis. They are the data you would use to test hypotheses.
Right.
Exactly right.
We're not getting into how you collect this data on these others. In fact, we're not sure how you would collect the data. But we're not even getting into that topic. So I'm not sure that we need to deal with those bullets that describe the data that would be collected. Don't we need to deal with the questions that the GAC asked and try to turn those into hypotheses? I think that's how we've approached it.
So far, you're right.
I think that makes sense, yeah.
So should we just delete this particular row in the table?
You know, in deference to a GAC that is anxious to see whether we're paying attention to what they wrote, let's find a way in a note somewhere to indicate that the GAC has suggested 2 data sets to be collected, and then we'll paste in their little 2 bullets so that it shows we gave recognition to the data sets they requested, but that this table focused on the hypotheses implied by the 15 questions that were asked in the GAC letter.
So what if we just...
The way the council, this is Tim, I guess, the way I see the council looking at these perhaps is that we would look at the questions as as perhaps individual studies. They might all be based on the same data, but whether that data is collected or not would be dependent on whether any one or more of those questions under for that data set would actually be something to pursue.
Agreed.
So how are we going to portray this one? It seems simplest if we can just leave it where it's at, but call it something different, and then under the recommendations column, just add the information that you were just describing, Steve. Does that work, and what would we call it?
It would be GAC Dataset 1, Suggested GAC Dataset 1, and Suggested GAC Dataset 2. That's more descriptive than calling them bullets. But putting them in here doesn't infer that there's a hypothesis associated with the data set. There's sort of suggestions from the GAC that if they had adhered to the format, they would have put it in their type of analysis required and data survey required.
Yeah. So are you thinking two separate rows, GAC data set 1 and a separate row for GAC data set 2, or should they be combined into one row in our table?
I think you could put them as two.
Okay. Anybody opposed to that?
We didn't have the second data set, did we, anywhere else up in the...
Yeah, we did. It's the, if I just can summarize briefly, the second bullet in the GAC letter, what I've been calling GAC data set two, is the types and extent of misuses of WHOIS data and what harm is caused by each type of misuse, including economic, spam, and abuse. Loss of reputation, identity theft, security costs, and loss of data.
So that's the one that right now we have in Area 1, right?
Let's go check that.
Because I'm having trouble then finding... Oh, yeah. And then
we called it GAC 2 on the last line.
3, yeah. So it should be... If we were to leave it in Area 1, we would rename that GAC data set 2.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah,
got it.
Good point.
And...
So we don't need the GAC data set 2 down below.
You know, we don't, but the way it's referred to up above in Area 1, we did not actually bring in all of the data elements that the GAC requested.
Yeah.
So, again, if we throw a bone to the GAC, it would be to include their two data sets explicitly somewhere, whether by link or by inclusion, and it could even be in a note.
So you're suggesting leaving... GAC data set 2 down below, as well as having it up above, and we've obviously just covered a subset of it in Area 1.
We did.
Okay. I'm okay with that. Anybody opposed to that?
So we would add a new row for GAC data set 2?
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
I think so.
Now
to make this easier for all of us, you actually circulated the GAC recommendations months and months ago. We don't have it linked at all on this wiki. Is the document available? We can quickly throw a link in so everybody can see that. Is it online anywhere?
We definitely should add a link on the wiki.
I mean, I have a PDF that Liz sent me, but I don't have a link to it.
Hey, can we link to it, Liz?
Sure, yeah.
Okay,
I'll add that to the wiki.
Add that to the wiki.
Yeah.
So let's at least try and wrap up or get a good idea where we're at on these two data sets. So under recommendations then for data set 1, what are we going to put? What's your thinking in that regard, Steve? Steve Del Bianco.
So this is back to Area 8.
Right. And then
if we actually have two rows in there, because this is the area where we're just saying other GAC recommendations.
Right.
We ought to have just two rows that recapture and perhaps just repeat that two of the other GAC recommendations were recommendations for data sets compilation. And without inferring which hypotheses would hinge on this data, to simply recount that the GAC has suggested two data sets be collected, data set 1, data set 2. And then we go on to look at to see whether any of the other GAC questions, the 1 through 15,
suggest a hypothesis that we're trying to flesh out here in this table. And that's what Eric does by putting in GAC 5, 6, and 3, right? He's trying to capture the other GAC questions and turn them into hypotheses.
Now, would it make sense to facilitate this, if we're just about out of time, to have a couple people work on Area 8 in preparation for our meeting next week? I guess maybe the better way to ask the question is do I have a is there a volunteer or two that would do that, taking into consideration what the discussion we've just had?
I can work with Liz on that. This is Steve the Dork. I could do that.
Liz the Dork will do that, too.
This is the Dork task? Okay.
You know, one thing, though. Steve is not a dork. I don't know if I should resent it.
Everyone wants to be a part of the team, you know? The one thing I would like to raise is whether either of these data sets belong in hypotheses. I kind of want to go back to the idea of adding it as a note rather than trying to shoehorn them in here. And my reason for that is that you wouldn't actually select one of these as a study to be done, right?
No, you're right. A note is fine for this.
Yeah, I would agree.
And it's easier to put them in these two GAC study suggestions. It's easier to put them in a footnote or top note than it is to note them every time we bring up a GAC hypothesis, because there's 15 of them scattered through here. We wouldn't have to have that note 15 times.
So Liz and Steve Del Bianco will work on this area, and that will mean creating a note or two notes, whichever way you want to do it, that would be added at the top of the table, and then taking a look at 5, 6, and 3 from the GAC. Is that correct? Now, is there a need to look at any of the other questions that may have been overlooked in the GAC?
Yeah, that's a great question. Do we think we've covered all 15 elsewhere?
See, I think we did. I think we made sure to do that, but we could double check easily enough.
Okay, so you guys can take
this
a look at that and then come back. So then,
this is Tim.
Go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to ask if the 15, I can't look at it here real quick, but the 15 were very clearly one relied on one data set or the other, or were in some cases they might rely on both. I was just wondering if it made sense to try to indicate, you know, which data set the particular recommendation or question might apply to or might require.
You know, Tim, it looks like most of them go off their second data set, which is the extent and type of misuse.
Yeah, I just, so whether we can do it here or not, I think the council will have to figure that out, because,
yeah,
you know, they're going to need to understand which data set needs to be collected to get.
But it's possible that the way we've structured it, I mean, remember we had an area called, I guess it was misuse, Area 1. If Area 1, and it includes at least a couple of the GAC items, if further study was needed, it would gather data about abuses of who is data that would feed multiple GAC questions. I mean, in other words, it may well be that council proceeds with a study pursuant to Area 1, and they say, look, this covers the GAC bullet number 1, so we're not going to worry about a separate consultant study to figure out how to answer the GAC's first data request.
All right, well, our time is done for today. So I appreciate Steve and Liz volunteering to work on the last area. And so next week what we will do then is we will confirm the work we did on Area 7, and certainly any comments are welcome on that during the week. And then we'll try and wrap up Area 8, and we'll also then follow up on the issue with Del Bianco's suggestion regarding the reference back to really pertinent details in the actual study recommendations. Any comments on that?
This is Steve. I think the charter was, we knew, as Jim said, we will link, we put a hyperlink. Every time we have a submission, it'll be hyperlinked to the original.
Right.
That's a technical thing. And the second thing was, I had volunteered to make one pass to see if there were items of particular note, like we came up with on this IDN stream,
right,
that deserved to be suggested to you guys as worthy of inclusion in the hypothesis table. And a few of them, I anticipate may be worthwhile, and that would just be my first pass.
Okay, that would be very helpful. Anything else? Okay, thanks everybody. Have a good rest of the week.
Thanks.
Thanks, Chuck. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.